My name is Mark Hummel, and this is Mark Hummel's Harmonic Party. And we're joining Charlie Musselwhite again, this time in California. Yeah, buddy, you'll get your word in. And we're just going to talk a little more about some of the stuff we left off with last time, which was Charlie left off with the time he was in Chicago right before he left for California. And you were just explaining to me how you made it out to California. You said somebody brought you out. Who was it that brought you out to California?
There was a disc jockey named Vaco. Huh. His real name, I think, was Abe Cash.
Okay.
And he was on the underground radio station. I forget the call letters now. It changed the letters. Come on now. A couple of times. And he got me a bunch of gigs, and he called me up, and I had no intentions really of touring or going anywhere. And
he wants his toy.
So I'd been putting off people that had been calling about gigs in different places. It just really wasn't enough money to travel that far to do, and I was having a great time in Chicago.
Right.
So
I want you to take that from
okay,
me.
You keep it. So Abe offered me a whole month of work for really good money, and I thought, well, I'll just go out there and make that money and come on back. But I went out to California, and right away, I knew I wasn't going back to Chicago.
Right.
People were really nice and evolved.
Right.
You know, evolved thinking.
Right.
It was the hippie era.
Right.
And the weather was great. San Francisco was a beautiful place. From talking to other people, I realized that the whole West Coast had a lot of places to play, and there were bigger rooms and even ballrooms and auditoriums like the Fillmore.
Right.
It paid way better than those little Chicago blues bars.
So now, did you come out, after Paul Butterfield and Bloomfield?
Yeah.
The following year?
My album came out in 67. I don't remember the date it came out, but I came out to California in the fall, August or September, something like that. And then my first gig was at the Fillmore with Butterfield and Cream.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. And then I worked a bunch of places around the New Orleans house in Berkeley.
Right, I remember that.
I don't remember where else.
You played Mandrakes a lot?
Yeah, I did. But I'm just talking about when I first...
Right, when you first made it.
This first little thing the guy had set up.
Right.
And I found an apartment in Berkeley, and my wife and son came out and joined me, and that was the beginning of living on the West Coast.
Now, did you live in that same one that Cahatzy used to live in?
Yeah, the Danbert apartment.
Right, right.
At the corner of College.
Yeah, College and Derby. Yeah, was that it?
That's where it was.
Yeah. So how did you meet Tim Cahatzy, anyway?
Well, he lived upstairs.
Uh-huh.
And I think he just came down and introduced himself one day. I don't really remember, but he would often come down and listen to my records. I had a lot of good records.
Yeah.
And we just became really good friends. And he was a pretty good guitar player. I didn't know anybody. The band I brought out, they all
went right back.
When we finished with those gigs, they all had their own ideas. Each one wanted their own band.
Huh.
And they're all going to come back. Harvey was the only one that actually did that. The other two went back to... Well, no, the drummer joined Cold Blood, I think.
Yeah, okay.
Sandy McKee.
Huh.
And,
but did everybody stay in California?
The bass player, Harry Motlow, went back to Chicago. Dave Cook was the keyboardist. He had a B3 with a piano, electric piano on top. He went back. And I thought for sure he was going to come the way he was talking. He had it all, I got it all figured out, you know. And then all that, he already was talking about the tunes he was going to be arranging, and the horn section and all this stuff. And
he had big ideas.
Yeah, so, and everybody's ideas were a little different than mine. I just wanted us to play blues.
Right, right.
And so we played those dates that the guy booked, and then we were all on our own. I started looking around. Tim knew a lot of people, so it was easy for him to
put something together for
you.
Yeah.
And at first, we just played some little college kind of places. And then later, as I got to know the area and got to get out and get around, I found the whole blues scene, like in Richmond and Oakland, and got to meet a lot of other musicians, and things just kept evolving. And
yeah.
At first it was a real scramble for me because I didn't have a booking agency, I didn't have a manager, and this was completely different from playing music in Chicago.
Oh yeah. You
know, blues joints. There wasn't any contracts or nothing.
Right.
I mean,
right.
So, I mean, this is like business, you know, real business. And I've thrown in the deep end of the pool and I don't know how to swim. Trial and error, I just figured it out as I went, you know, and tried not to repeat too many mistakes.
Right.
And I used to go down to 8th Street.
And you told me they would just look at you like you're from another planet.
I used to like to go to 8th Street because, to me, it was better than any zoo I'd ever been in.
Exactly.
And, you know, it was really interesting and far out. And, you know, I just stand and watch the parade. I mean, it was people with wild hair and beads and that perfume that I hate.
Oh, patchouli.
That stuff is horrible.
But you told me the hippies would come up and go,
well, this one
hey,
guy,
man, far. You,
this one guy came up to me one time and said, wow, man, are you Charlie Musselwhite? I said, yeah. He said, man, you're weird. So he had, you know, hair out to here and all kind of a pirate shirt or something. And I had on shades and my hair slicked back.
Oh, that's great.
I wore like a sport coat or black sport coat or something. I had pointed toe shoes, and which was the style of Chicago.
Sure, yeah.
But I didn't care. You know, to me, it was all amusing.
Right.
I choose to be amused as much as I can.
Right.
But the hippies were real open to everything.
Right.
You know? And they were playing my record on the
San Francisco
Underground
stations.
Radio, which was the hippie radio.
Right.
And everybody tuned into that.
Yeah.
I wish I could remember the call letters. The disc jockey at one of those stations, Tom Donahue.
Oh, Tom Donahue, right.
He was part of helping book us to get us to come out to California.
Right.
He was
a
great guy.
Yeah.
I was getting played a lot, and the kids knew who I was, and they'd come to the clubs. And
yeah.
So I just suddenly had this career, you know.
Right. Well, it's kind of, I remember there's a real famous photograph of Haight Street, of all these people on Haight Street, and the Straight Theater has a marquee that says Charlie Musselwhite on it.
Yeah,
it's like a real famous
there's a
photo.
That theater's not there. There's a Goodwill there where that theater was.
Right, exactly.
But with the people, the street was full of people in the middle of the day or the afternoon because the Grateful Dead was going to do a free concert on
Flatbed
truck or something.
I think that's what it's from, yeah.
There's even people up on the tops of buildings looking down. So I played that night at the Straight Theater.
So did you get to know some of the hippie bands and stuff at that time? Or?
Yeah, I knew Jerry Garcia. Uh-huh. You know, not well, but I remember he was always friendly and we would talk. I don't remember what we talked about. But.
And Nick was already out here.
Nick had been coming out to California as a folk singer.
Right.
When he was in Chicago, him and Paul had kind of like a Sonny Terry, Brandy McGee thing.
Right, right.
And Nick was like the big name.
Nick had come out here with Paul in the early 60s, too.
And, well, Nick was coming out alone at first. He was a singer-songwriter, folk singer. Played guitar, and he played probably around North Beach and stuff.
Right,
I'm not
sure
exactly where he played.
You're right.
And around Chicago, Paul was his harmonica player.
Right.
And I don't know that they played together as a duo in California. I know.
Yeah, he told me they drove out here. Nick told me that.
Oh, okay. Well, that.
Yeah, he said they came out here.
I know that Paul had come out to California. So when he came back to Chicago, I remember he had kind of a sunburn.
Right.
I saw him one time at it was Little Walter and Robert Nighthawk playing at some kind of thing at the University of Chicago.
Right, right.
And Paul showed up. And that's, I heard Little Walter play guitar that night, too.
Huh, wow.
But he was probably coming out during the Beatnik era.
He might have been.
The tail end of it. So he was already established on a certain level. And then Paul, he got his own band going. And he played at some of the same clubs I played in.
Yeah, because you told me they used to confuse you and him.
People come up to me and say, "You're Paul, right?" No. "You play harmonica, right?" "Yeah, you're Paul." "No, I'm not." And we kind of...
Well, it's just such a freak thing to have two white guys playing blues harmonica.
Yeah, Paul used to joke about we had harmonica players' eyebrows. Right. He said we had the same eyebrows.
Right. Same hairstyle.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
I lived on 61st Place in Chicago at the dead end of Blackstone, right in the heart of the Blackstone Ranger gang area. And Paul lived on the other side of 55th, I think, which was Hyde Park.
Right, right.
Where the University of Chicago is.
Where the university is,
Nice neighborhood.
Right.
Where I lived was not a nice neighborhood at all. In fact, you could die there.
Right.
Easily.
Real easily. Yeah.
Paul would call me up and say, "Hey, man, come on over if you're not doing anything. And let's get high and listen to some records or something." And before he'd hang up, he'd say, "Can you bring me a Pepsi?" He always wanted a cold Pepsi. Instead of coffee in the morning, he'd like to have a cold Pepsi.
That's funny. It must have been the caffeine.
Yeah, man, it was cold and wet and sweet and went down easy. So I'd bring him a Pepsi and we'd sit around and smoke a joint and play records and talk about harmonica. I remember he had a new Ramsey Lewis album and there was some lick that Ramsey played and he was...
figuring it out.
Yeah. So, and I did the same sort of thing where instead of listening to other harmonica players, I listened to other instruments for phrasing and ideas that you haven't heard before on harmonica.
Well, I think that the Chicago harmonica players, it seemed like in that time period, were really hip to jazz. I remember you were one of the first guys I heard doing, you and Butterfield and Little Walter and people like that were doing, jazz tunes on the harmonica before anybody else.
Well, all the clubs had jukeboxes and they all had like Jack McDuff and Jimmy Smith and Lou Donaldson and all those jazz blues kind of guys on those jukeboxes. That was popular music in Chicago.
Right.
On the South Side, anyhow. And, another place I lived was in Old Town, and there were a lot of jazz clubs around there.
Hmm.
And since I lived in the neighborhood, I could get in and see anybody for free. And all the door people knew me. And I remember Roscoe Mitchell and Jackie McLean and, just a lot
of Chicago jazz guys.
Yeah, but there were guys that would come. Jackie McLean didn't live there. A lot of guys would tour coming through there and play. The clubs that would have jazz or blues, they had both.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of jazz players would come to blues gigs. And there would be jam sessions. There were... In Hyde Park, there was I don't know where Roscoe Mitchell lived, but there was somebody had a basement apartment, a big apartment, and there was every Tuesday or something, there was all these jazz guys would be there just jamming.
Wow.
And they were playing way out,
avant-garde stuff.
Yeah, if you've heard Roscoe Mitchell, you know what I mean.
Yeah, I haven't really heard him.
So I would hang out there a lot. I mean, I don't know if I was learning anything, but it must have had some effect on me somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And then a lot of the just regular old school jazz players around too. A guy like Little Brother Montgomery, he played blues, but he could play anything.
Oh yeah, he could play anything.
And he could play jazz and
played trad jazz too. He's a great trad jazz guy.
He was good at that. He played in a lot of Dixieland.
That's
clubs.
What I heard.
There was a club right on 63rd. At Dorchester, I can't remember the name of it, but it had a bandstand behind the bar. And I'd walk over there and sit at the bar and listen to jazz all night, you know, many, many times.
Wow.
And Junior Wells lived right on Dorchester's.
I'd Did he?
Pass by his apartment on the way to this club.
Did you know him pretty good?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Senior? Yeah.
Yeah.
We became friends
right
away. Mm-hmm. He was a good guy. And we would pass each other often going and coming from the liquor store.
Oh, okay.
The Red Rooster, it was the Red Rooster grocery store and liquor store.
Huh.
And we were always making trips back and forth to the...
That's funny.
I mean, I was in there so much, as soon as I walked in the door, they started putting it on the counter. They knew what I wanted.
Speaking of alcohol...
Yeah.
So I just wanted to get into the thing of, you know, that you've been sober now for, what, 36 years?
Since 87.
Since 87, yeah. Yeah, so I sobered up in 84, so... Yeah. You got over 34 years, something like that?
I don't know.
35, yeah.
You can add it up.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
I don't have, I quit the one for my chip, so I lost track.
Right. What got you sober? I mean, you're one of the first real drinkers I was around back in the day. I'd say you and Brownie and Johnny Waters and some of the guys I was hanging around were could all put it away in a pretty mighty
way.
Well,
I came out of an environment where everybody I knew drank.
Right.
Paul drank too. I mean,
right.
We were both big drinkers. And even where I grew up in the South, I mean, it was just a...
It was a way of life.
Men drank.
Right.
And
I think in the blues world, it was particularly
everybody,
a part of the culture.
Everybody I knew drank.
Yeah.
Men and women. And,
yeah.
And it wasn't... Didn't have any stigma to it.
Right.
And the thing was, you're supposed to know how to hold your liquor. You know?
Right, right.
Anyhow, it got out of hand. And I got up to where I was drinking 2 quarts of liquor a day.
Oh, my God.
And I at some point had some moment of clarity where I realized, this is insane.
Right.
You're killing yourself.
Right.
This cannot keep going. This you have to, but I couldn't figure out. It's funny now looking back on it. I couldn't figure out how do you stop. I mean,
right.
I couldn't. How do you do that?
I know it didn't seem like something you could do.
I'd never been on a stage sober.
Yeah, me neither.
I'd never been on a stage with anybody that wasn't drunk.
Right, exactly.
And it all went together. So
yeah.
It just fit together all so perfectly. And
yeah,
and. But I knew that this was crazy. And so my first idea was, well, I'll just start cutting down. And so I'd wait an hour each day when I woke up. I'd wait another hour before I had that first drink. I used to just drink, if I was awake, I would drink.
Yeah, you used to drink first thing.
I would drink if I was awake.
Right, right.
Night or day,
right.
I would drink.
Yeah.
I'd keep a bottle on the floor.
Right.
By the bed. In the middle of the night, I could have a hit. So I would wait an hour, and I remember getting all the way up to noon without a drink, and I thought that was cause for celebration, so I had a drink, of course. And finally, I got to where I didn't drink all day.
Right.
I could go 24 hours without a drink. I thought, this is kind of working out. But I'd never been on a stage sober. I'd never played sober. And I didn't feel comfortable. I never was one that was interested in being in the spotlight and mm-hmm. having attention and people looking at me, playing
right.
and me putting on a show. None of that ever appealed to me
right.
at all. I remember one time Mike Bloomfield telling me that the best thing in the world to him would be in a room full of people and everybody looking at him.
You told me.
And when he said that, just a shudder just went through my body. I thought, because I felt like exactly the opposite.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but if I was drinking, getting on stage
matter.
And playing
yeah.
was
yeah.
nothing to it.
Right,
you know?
Right.
I didn't care.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
This is a party, boy.
Yeah.
So, now, this is the last hurdle, how to get on stage without drinking. And I was driving to work and going to a club in Santa Cruz. And I'm listening to the news, and they're talking about this little girl that fell in the well in Texas. Mm-hmm. Jessica McClure was her name. And she's down in the bottom of this well. I think she has a broken arm. And they've lowered a microphone down to where they can communicate with her. And there she is in the dark at the bottom of this well, and she's singing nursery rhymes to herself. Mm. Is in the news, they're telling me this. And I was struck by how brave she was. Here she was in a real life and death situation. Maybe she was too young to even realize the situation. But certainly she had to know something was messed up. I mean, to be in the dark at the bottom of a hole.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Stuck with a broken arm.
Right.
I really wanted her to live. And I really wanted her to survive this thing. And it was really dicey.
Yeah.
Because it could cave in. They didn't know how to get to her without it caving in and all this stuff. And I told Henrietta, I said, that's it. I'm not drinking until they get her out of the well. And it was my version of a prayer for her. Mm-hmm. I was not going to drink in her honor because then I thought of myself and I thought, what's the big deal with you, buddy? I mean, here's something you know perfectly well how to do. You've done it 1,000 times.
Right.
Just get on the fucking stage and play. What's the problem? You know, what's the big deal? You know, and here's this little girl being so brave, you know.
Right.
If you had just a fraction of her bravery, you could go play. What's the deal? And it kind of put a perspective on things for me. And they didn't. So I got to the club and I'm saying to Henry, you know, I could use a drink. And she told the waitress, bring one of every non-alcoholic drink you have to this table. I had a Coke and a 7-Up and water and ginger ale. And I remember being on stage and I'm like sweating and gagging and my knees felt like jelly. I felt like I was going to faint or something. And then when I got off stage, everybody said, man, you sounded great. I've never heard you sound so good. And I thought, yeah, well, okay. And the other part of the story is it took them about 3 days to get her out of the well, as I recall.
It might have been longer.
And by then, yeah. I was out of the well, too. I just never had a drink since.
Yeah, that's a beautiful story.
Yeah. And then when it was over, it was like, damn, what was that all about? You know? What took so long? Why was it so confusing? You know.
Well, you had a lot of people pass, too. I mean, you know, that were alcoholics.
Oh, yeah, a lot of good friends.
We were talking about Charlie moving out to the West Coast and how he quit drinking 35 years ago and many other exploits. But you know what I wanted to get into with you is the latter part of your career, and specifically I'd love to talk about the last two records you did, both the one with Elvin and your newest solo one that's doing so well. But you have worked with so many like really famous people in the last, you know, 30 years or so. I mean, between In Excess, didn't you record with those guys?
Mm-hmm.
In Excess, and particularly Cyndi Lauper and then Ben Harper. And then the Blind Boys of Alabama, I think you got something coming up with those guys.
Yeah, we got a couple of tours coming up.
Yeah. But, I mean, those were real game changers for your career, right? I mean, especially Cyndi Lauper and Ben Harper, it seems like.
Well, it got me in front of huge audiences of people that had never heard of me, and it was fun.
Yeah.
I remember with Cyndi, she would point to me to take a solo, you know, and the spotlight would be on her.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm taking a solo, but the spotlight stays on her. And I'm looking out at the audience and all the people looking at Cyndi, looking at me.
How funny.
And so finally she would come and make the spotlight follow her and
uh-huh.
she'd stand behind me.
Ah,
so they
okay.
had to put the spotlight
That's
on
interesting.
Her.
Wow. Crazy.
And but it's surprising at the reception. This wasn't a blues audience or nothing, and I wasn't a young guy, and like with Ben Harper, people just lit up when I would be playing, and Ben had me sing a few songs too each night.
Right.
And people really, really went for it. I was amazed at how much they had totally they accepted me and seemed to really be knocked out by what I was doing.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't a blues crowd.
So do you think that has to do with the whole thing of that people just don't get a chance to hear blues harmonica as
that's
much?
I think that's a valid idea that these were people that never heard blues harmonica. They didn't really know much about blues. But I've always said that if anybody is ever exposed to blues properly, you can't help but like it.
Right.
Almost everybody likes it when they hear it.
Right.
A lot of people hear stuff that's not really blues. They think it's blues.
Right.
Like I remember one time a guy saying, like Birth of the Blues, that's a great song. That's, that's a great song, but that's not really the blues. So he really had no clue what I was talking about.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are like that. People that think they know what blues is hadn't really heard it.
Right, right.
So, like I say, once they hear the real deal, people can't deny it.
Right.
They just got to hear more of that. So in that situation, a rock situation, and they hear this blues, like in some rock bands, there's some harmonica playing, but it's pretty sloppy and not really, not the real deal. So when they hear something played the way we would play it, it really opens the ears up.
Right.
And so it was a lot of fun.
Well, it's a nice thing that you got, that you got a break like that. And that's something I think most musicians, because blues musicians, we were talking about this in the car, we're really just want to work. You know, that's really 90% of it. It's just we want to be able to apply our trade and,
Well, for me, it's interesting to see how I can fit into a different situation.
Right, right.
Like with this Cuban music.
Right.
I love how, for me, it just seems so natural to go together. Blues phrasing with the Cuban song.
Right.
Traditional song.
Right.
Or with whoever. Like doing, Cindy did a blues album. She recorded in Memphis, and the album's called Memphis Blues. And then we toured together for 2 years. So we would do some blues tunes, and then we'd do some of her hits, like Girls Just Want to Have Fun.
And you'd play on those.
Now have a harmonica solo.
Right.
And I remember one morning we did one of those morning TV shows, like 8 in the morning or something, out in the middle of Times Square.
Right.
All the neon.
Oh, yeah.
And just me and the piano player and Cindy doing Girls Just Want to Have Fun. True Colors. I really enjoyed it. Just her and I would do that as a duo.
Yeah, yeah.
She'd play, dulcimer.
Oh, okay.
And with a slide sometimes.
Yeah.
I remember she'd say, "Nothing says blues like a mountain dulcimer." I can't really do her accent, but she's a delightful woman.
Yeah. She was real good friends with Johnny Ace. Did you know that?
I know that they knew each other.
Yeah.
I think they knew each other back when she first was getting started.
Right, exactly. Yep.
But she's so, she can be real silly and she can get as deep as you want to get.
Yeah.
And she can also be as heavy as you want to get. I mean,
right.
You do not want to cross that woman.
I've heard.
And I've seen her just chew people up and spit them out.
Oh, I bet.
And it's like a work of art. I just loved it. I'd be going, yes.
She's very practiced at it.
Well, she just won't put up for any baloney, And I don't blame her. She's
right.
But she also has a huge heart and does a lot to help a lot of people that you never hear about.
Yeah.
She doesn't do it for...
That's beautiful.
For publicity or nothing.
Yeah.
It's just right from the heart.
That's great.
She's a fabulous person.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
So we're still in touch.
And that's great. You guys are still in touch.
I got an email from her just a few days ago.
Good. That's great. Well, you've done quite a few albums, on Alligator, isn't that right? Over the last, 20 years or something?
Yeah, I don't know. Half a dozen, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you've put out records on your own?
Yeah, on the Henrietta label.
On the Henrietta label?
Yeah, that was my idea.
So
it was a good decision. So,
good name, too.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious, how do you decide which ones end up on a big label like Alligator and which ones you decide to put out yourself? What kind of determines that?
Well, you know, like an Alligator really knows how to sell records.
Mm-hmm.
They have a real good distribution. They do real good promotion and around the world. And they've got the blues community covered. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And they have contacts that are real old. They're still, you know, they've created a whole network.
Right.
And the people that work at Alligator have been there a long time. It's not a fast turnover there. They
right.
all love the music. They love working there despite...
Don't say it.
You know, I have a real good relation with Bruce, and I think the world of him. He's a good friend, but he can make you nuts. Bruce knows that, and it's okay. We all, none of us are perfect. But the whole Alligator thing is really a work of the heart.
Yeah.
Labor of love.
Yeah.
So it's nice to be connected with that. And they
yeah.
get things done and they do them right. And they know they've been doing it long enough to really have some momentum behind anything they put
yeah.
out.
And
they,
yeah.
this last album, Mississippi Sun, they really, I was surprised at how excited they were about it.
Yeah.
And,
it's done really well, hasn't it?
It's been getting
rave reviews.
The best reviews I've
yeah.
ever gotten.
Right.
Man.
Didn't you get Rolling Stone quote out of?
I think so. There's been
yeah.
so many, I've
yeah.
lost track.
Yeah. And it's charted real well, as I recall.
It was the number one on the blues charts for 2 months, or wow. Living Blues.
That's great.
One of those.
No, that's the radio. That's radio yeah. stuff, yeah. That's great.
I don't know how that compares to other.
No, that's really good.
For me, I haven't been number one for 2 months.
Yeah.
Of anything, anywhere.
No, that's great. That's great. And I should mention that on that album, you're playing guitar, I think, on almost every song, right?
The way that happened was the pandemic hit, and suddenly I've got all this time on my hands. I never, hadn't had this much time on my hands since I was a teenager or something. And I'm loving it.
Yeah,
I'm getting things done around the house. I can actually start something and finish it without having to pack and leave. Again.
Right.
My suitcase used to be open all the time because I was going to fill it up and leave again.
Same here.
So now I actually got to put it away.
Yeah.
And I'm hanging out at the Clarksdale Soundstage, which is owned by a real good friend of mine named Gary Vincent and his wife Carol Vincent. He's a singer-songwriter, and they... we're in Nashville, and the whole music scene there. He wrote with a lot of famous people there. He's got guitars laying around, or I bring a guitar over, and I'm just playing stuff. And one day he said, you know, I should be taping some of these songs you're playing. Yeah, sure, go ahead. So every now and then, I'd tape another couple or three, I don't know. And at some point, I think Henrietta said, you know, this could be an album. And we thought, yeah, I think she's right. So then we got a local drummer and bass player to come in on some more tunes. And I thought it was okay, you know. I kind of liked the tunes. There's tunes I've been doing for a long time, just for myself or for nobody else. And sent it to the Alligator to see what they thought. And boy, they wanted it.
Did they?
And their enthusiasm really made me happy. I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
With that kind of enthusiasm, you know you're going to get a,
right.
a good service.
Right, they're going to do a good job. Yeah.
And,
yeah.
So that's how that worked out. It just started out just spontaneous. It wasn't even a plan. It just happened
yeah.
because of the pandemic.
Well, I really enjoyed the choice of tunes that you did on it, too. The what's the second to the last one on there?
I don't know.
You told me somebody wrote it. And I'm trying to think of who it was, some Americana artist. Guy Clark, right.
Oh, The Dark.
That's a great song.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
He didn't play it the way I played it. I turned
yeah.
it into a blues. It wasn't a blues.
I really liked
it,
though.
It.
Yeah.
But the lyrics I liked so well.
Yeah.
And as soon as I heard his version, I could see how they could be, I could adapt that to how I play guitar. And,
mm-hmm.
And, I had fun turning that into a blues.
Yeah, I loved it. And
yeah,
then
you
did
you.
A spiritual, I think, in the very end.
Yeah.
Right?
The real name is The Voice We're Told, but I used to call it something else. I forgot.
Yeah, but it's a deep song.
Yeah, I learned it with the Blind Boys of Alabama.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've done that with them. Okay, Buster.
I remember no comments playing, from the peanut gallery, Buster.
I remember being with the Blind Boys of Alabama at the Lincoln Jazz Center in New York City, and we backed up Ralph Stanley.
Oh, wow.
And, man.
What a show.
Wow, that was so... I remember literally getting goosebumps.
Right, right.
And
so he was with the Blind Boys.
He was singing solo and wow. Blind Boys, and I backed him up.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and I remember I had his biography with me. I got him to sign it, and he wasn't much of a talker. I'd say, you know that song, so and so. I really like that song. He said, "Yep, that's a good one." You know. He was kind of a shy guy.
Yeah.
I really was glad to meet him, though.
Well, you guys are both country boys.
Yeah.
You know? The other album I really wanted to just tell you how much I love is the 100 Years of Blues record.
Oh, yeah.
Of you and Elvin. Because to me, that album really caught me by surprise. Because, I mean, I'd heard you guys before, and you guys, I think, had already been doing the duo thing by that time.
We started out, the way that came about, we did these package shows for a company called CAMI. Mm-hmm. I forget what the letters stand, CAMI. You know, they had a bus, and we'd all get on the bus, and mm-hmm. I remember it'd be, I don't know, half a dozen of us, and we'd play in different configurations, you know. Mm-hmm. Elvin would play with the front of the rhythm section or something, and then I would do something, and then we'd come back and do something together. We'd sit down side by side and just do a duo. And it really went over well, and we enjoyed doing it too. And then somehow we got into doing more of that. They would book us into these performing arts centers, just me and Elvin.
Right.
And we would get somebody to back us up too, like Bob Welsh.
Like Bob Welsh, yeah.
Piano or guitar.
Right.
And he's a great player, and great to have him behind us.
Yeah, Bob's a great...
It gives us some freedom to...
Yeah.
So anyhow...
Great choice.
And, you know, Elvin will do a tune, and I'll do a tune, and in between we'll tell stories and just talk. None of it's planned out. We don't rehearse this stuff. You know, like I'll do a Sonny Boy tune, and I'll tell a Sonny Boy story that might occur to me at that moment.
Yeah, yeah.
So we have a lot of fun, and I've always said if you're having fun on stage, the audience is going to have fun too.
Right.
So
right.
We do. It's as easy as falling off a log.
Right.
And we really enjoy the same music.
Yeah.
And we enjoy playing together.
You guys have known each other forever.
Yeah, we've known each other since we back in the old Chicago days.
Right.
In fact, when Elvin was playing with Butterfield before Bloomfield, I thought that was a better band.
Right. I remember we were talking about that before.
It was
before.
More of a real blues band.
More of a real blues band. I agree.
And Mike just rocked it up.
Rocked it up.
For my taste.
Yeah, yeah. No, you're right. Their records were really good together.
Yeah.
Or their original, because the original recordings were just a four-piece.
I remember I was at the sessions.
Yeah.
In
were you
York
at those
City.
Sessions? Yeah.
A lot of those tunes I remember that were recorded. Not sure they ever got released. There's some instrumentals.
Yeah, they did. They did release it on there's an album called What's Shaken that had some of those songs on it.
Well, What's Shaking, the one I know, was like a sampler.
It was a sampler.
It had like four different groups or something on it.
But they had like three or four on that.
But there was a whole lot of more stuff.
Oh, I know there was.
It was not released, as far as I know.
Right. No, that got released later on. There's an album, I think it's called Golden Butter, that has a bunch of the outtakes.
I like to hear that.
Yeah, it's got Too Late Brother on there by Lil Walter. And quite a few Lil Walter songs.
Yeah, all did a lot of Lil Walter.
Did a lot of Lil Walter,
But I remember being in the studio there watching them record in New York City.
Right. And it sounded good.
It sounded great.
And that wasn't, Bluefield wasn't there.
No. I mean, Mike and I used to take the Greyhound out to New York City kind of regularly whenever we could.
Right.
Just to check out the scene, see what was going on. And we knew John Hammond, and we'd call up John and see what's going on. That's how that album of his came out, the... So Many Roads, So Many Trains.
Right. One with the band on it.
Robbie Robertson on guitar. Then he was called Jamie Robertson.
Right, that's
and
right.
Levon Helm and Garth and all those guys.
Yeah, right.
It was them, and Mike and I showed up and called John to see what's going on. Said, come on down to the studio.
What a
recording.
Trip. Yeah.
So I went straight down there.
That's great.
Dylan was there hanging out. And,
yeah.
And that's how that happened. I mean, it was just a coincidence.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a pretty good record.
Yeah, yeah.
And when Mike heard Robbie play, he went over to the piano.
He was a little intimidated, huh?
I guess. Well, it was better to have piano than another guitar.
Right, anyhow. Right. But I was going to say, you know, the Elvin album, you know, the UN Elvin album is such a, it's such a great kind of relaxed feel on it. That's what I really loved about it, is it really did sound like totally organic and you know, you guys didn't rehearse anything to death. You just sat down and played. And it's really got a great vibe to it in terms of you guys being able to lock in together on it, you know.
It's just a natural fit. I mean, to play together. We like the same tunes, and we really enjoy playing together.
Yeah.
So it's, it sounds good.
And like I was telling you, I mean, you mentioned the same song that I was thinking of, which was Midnight Hour Blues is so heavy.
Yeah, I love that.
So
tune.
Heavy.
And I love the way Elvin does it. It's
he sings really, it.
It's just real blues.
Real deep,
Real
deep.
You can't deny it.
Sure is.
And he does it in a real special way. And I look forward to doing that. We do it just about every night.
Yeah, good.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, let's play a song or two, man, if you're okay with that.
Okay.
Okay.
How about some 8-bar blues?
Yeah, go head on.
An E.
Yeah, that sounds good. Charlie,
yes, sir.
It's been a pleasure, man.
Always a pleasure.
It's always fun to talk to you, and you have so many great stories. I know you could go on for days, and I could be prying more stuff out of you, but I really enjoyed this.
Sometime.
Yeah, I love it.
Send in your questions, folks.
And send in your questions. Buy yourself a CD.
Mississippi Sun, I think.
Yeah.
I'm playing guitar on every tune.
All right.
And overdubbed harmonica.
Was it all overdubbed? Did you do any rack tarp on there?
I could play on the rack, but I could play so much better without the rack.
Without it,
I thought it'd be more effective.
I can see that. But yeah. Well, it sounds like a natural thing.